Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, are my amigos, my comrades, my compatriots, Mr. Chad Riley.
Hi.
And Spencer Williams.
Hey.
he's so tentative. He's like, do I say hello to you or do I not?
Of course you say hello. Why wouldn't you say hello?
I would say hello to you.
What kind of response is that?
You know, it depends on what kind of hello I'm going to give you.
You know what?
There's styles.
And if there's one thing Spencer is about, he's about style.
Yeah, everyone knows I'm about style.
We got a great show in store for you as we're going to be talking about the recently released film, Blindspotting. So stick around as we get into that. But before we do, Chad, let him know.
Let them know. As a trio of film fanatics who are always looking to stay on the right side of the law and usually succeeding, The Filmlosophers is brought to you by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios. If you're a fan of spoken word, or just like to hear people talking, you should subscribe to The Filmlosophers on your favorite streaming platform to get access to new episodes each Wednesday on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and or Audio Boom.
We're all over the place.
Are you ready to raise your voice and be heard? We'd love to hear from you on our social media pages. Like our page on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. It goes without saying that history has a lot to teach us, and we're building quite a history on this show.
That we are.
Visit our website at filmlosophers.com and take all the time you need to listen to our entire library of more than 100 episodes.
I think that is the first time I have heard Spencer do that with so much confidence and gusto.
He got all the way through it without you interrupting him.
That's true.
I
was enthralled. I was enraptured. I was just encapsulated. I was like, I am in the presence
Man,
of this.
We are in the flow, guys.
That we are, man. Well, like we said, we got a great show in store. We're going to be talking about the recently released film in theaters, Blindspotting. Now, if you haven't heard about it, it is a independent type film that honestly we had to wait until like 10 o'clock to see it at night, but it was actually really well worth it, and we'll talk about it as we dive in. But before we do, Chad, give him that official synopsis goodness.
I sure will. Colin must make it through his final 3 days of probation for a chance at a new beginning. He and his troublemaking childhood best friend Miles work as movers, like people who physically help you move from one place to another. And when Colin witnesses a police shooting, the two men's friendship is tested as they grapple with identity and their changed realities in the rapidly gentrifying neighborhoods they grew up in Oakland, California.
That's right. Directed by Carlos Lopez Estrada, the film stars David Diggs, Rafael Casal, Janina Gavankar, Jasmine Cephas-Jones, and Ethan Embry. Just a quick note, the music that you're hearing actually is in the film. So just before anybody starts wondering, like, wait, you're going to be talking about Oakland and you got this playing? Yes, this music is in the film, which is...
I mean, it's like the opening sequence, really.
Which, in certain aspects, speaks highly to the type of film this is. So it's really interesting. Blindspotting premiered at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year and was released in theaters in late July. The film was filmed in Oakland during the summer of 2017, concurrently with another indie film that is currently in theaters, Sorry to Bother You. We got a chance to check out this film, and needless to say, I'm going to be pretty honest, I wasn't really too sure what we were going to see. I hadn't seen any trailers. It didn't come across. I usually try to pride myself in being able to locate like certain indie films, like really being in the know of what's going on. And we've just been so rampant, I don't want to put that on anybody else. I've just been so rampant in focusing on like summer blockbusters and things of that sort that it wasn't until it took a conversation with someone else who is a filmmaker here locally in Sacramento that, and it's funny, I'm talking about this and I'm watching Chad sway to this.
I mean, this is like, I don't know what you'd call it, but my brain is jumbled.
You can be jumbled.
I remember seeing this movie and hearing this music in it, but still I'm like, what is this music doing with this movie?
It took a conversation with somebody who is a filmmaker here in Sacramento, and he had mentioned, he said, you know what, one of the best films I've seen so far this year was Blindspotting. And I'm like, I have no idea what movie you're talking about. Like, in my mind, I thought he was trying to say Trainspotting, which is the European film with Ewan McGregor,
which is
Irish film, however,
like years old.
Very much. Even
the sequel is a couple of years old.
Exactly. And so I was thinking, I'm like, well, maybe he means that. And he's like, no. It's a film that just debuted this year. And it's really great. You got to check it out. And so it wasn't until I talked to Spencer, and Spencer was the one who actually hyped it up more for the group here, for the three of us, and kind of sold it to us about us needing to go see it.
Mm-hmm.
Spencer, yeah, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
My buddy Marcus, who I work with, cool guy, he was the one who actually suggested it to me because I had not heard it before. So one day I just had nothing to do. So I was like, well, I'm going to check out this movie. And sorry to bother you as well. So I checked out both movies and I was just blown away by this movie. I was like, we have to talk about this movie because this movie is so good.
Mm-hmm. I first heard about it. I remember, when something like Sundance that used to be smaller and now is enormous. Yeah, I mean, Sundance, the Toronto International Film Festival, Tribeca Film Festival, things like that. There's a lot of news that comes out about all kinds of different movies that are debuting. I do remember seeing the movie title. I don't think I ever read a review of it because it's hard to keep track. They literally have movies showing all day for like a week or 4 days or something. But so I never read a review about it. I kind of forgot that it had ever been mentioned. And then Spencer, you were the one that brought it up after you saw it and said, we really need to do this if we have any room on our schedule. And of course we were just going by, you know, the Hollywood plan, right? Where it's like, oh, let's watch, you know, The Meg. And we kind of, in a way, we had an opening in our schedule for this week, which worked out really, really well because to a certain extent, Blindspotting has gone nationwide. It is not what I would call a wide release film.
No.
Because it still can be difficult to find a showing at a time that works for you in your area.
Yeah.
It was even hard here because by the time we guys went to see it, it was only on at 10.
I remember me and Spence were here at the house and we were talking and we were like, okay, we got to see this film. We're going to go and see it this weekend. Spence, by the time we had talked about it, Spence had already seen it once prior. And Chad and I were looking to go and see it. So we're scouring all over the theaters online to find out an available place. And we're like, Spencer, this movie's only playing in one theater, and it's playing at 10 o'clock at night.
And it's not even the art theater in our
area. No, which
is super weird.
It's usually where you find like super independent films is usually at a different theater than where this one actually is showing.
And so I was like, Spence, did you wait this late to see the film? And he's like, no, I saw it during the middle of the day. It was around 3 o'clock or whatever. Yeah. I'm like, and for me, in my mind, knowing how theaters work and how they rotate things out.
Absolutely.
I immediately thought, well, then this probably isn't a great movie. It's probably one of those films that's on the outs. It's getting ready to be rotated out. It probably didn't do well if it just released like within the last few weeks in July. And it's only got apparently like 2 or 3 weeks in theaters. It probably isn't that great of a film. And that was my thinking. That was my initial thinking. That was my ignorant thinking, if you will.
I will.
Yeah, I know you will.
How ignorant of you.
I know, right? And so I was like, all right, well, I'm not going to lie. I'm going to be brutally honest in this episode because of the fact that I think one of the things that this film really emulates is transparency, and I think that's one of the things that should really come across when we talk about this film. And I'm going to be fully honest. I didn't think this film was going to be any good. I didn't really think it was. No offense to Spencer, which Spencer said it was a good movie, but then again, Spencer also liked Sharknado. So I'm just
there's different levels with me. Like, I'm not going to put them on the same level.
There's different levels.
There are levels.
It's like I like getting a raise at work, and I like pizza. They're different.
Well.
Thank you.
I'm glad you cleared the air with that one. Thank you, Chad. But
I'm always here to help.
But yeah, that was my mindset. I was like, okay, it's on its way out, obviously, with the theaters. It's only playing in one theater in Sacramento. And mind you, Sacramento is not the largest film market in California.
No.
But it's getting to be bigger. It's growing.
And I think it bears saying in this exact case, we're not far from the Bay Area, which is where the movie is set. So people from the Bay Area, myself included, I lived in the Bay Area for a while, like people migrate from there to here.
Yeah.
So there's likely a pretty good amount of the local population here in our area in Sacramento, California, that would be interested in this film.
Yeah, no
doubt. Because of the setting, if no other reason.
Yeah.
But there are other reasons to be interested, rest assured.
Of course, no. And so, obviously, we made the trek to the theater, the only theater that was playing it. We went late at night, the day before a work day, which I don't know if anybody...
We walked uphill both ways.
In snow and sleet. And so we went and we got a chance to see the film. And needless to say, the movie moved us. The movie was very interesting, to where it began sparking conversation within the three of us immediately as soon as we walked outside the theater doors. We were ready to start talking and ready to start dialoguing. And had I not have been so tired, I probably would have said, guys, let's save this for the podcast. But I'm like, you know what? It's just, yeah, this was great. This was, you know, but it was definitely a film that surprised me. And I don't know if I'm the only one that feels that way, but there are very interesting dynamics of this film that I did not expect to come to light, like certain ways that they film it and certain structures and so forth that we'll talk about. But I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, it's a very impressive film. I mean, for not having the biggest, broadest platform, at least as of yet. I mean, who knows? They'll start announcing contenders for Oscars and Producers Guild, Writers Guild, Screen Actors Guild, all that kind of stuff. They'll start announcing some of those in the near future, so maybe it'll get some additional press and exposure there. I think it certainly merits it.
Oh, no doubt.
It does surprise you because it's not a summer blockbuster kind of movie. It's not even necessarily a drama in the traditional sense of, I don't know, like the Tom Hanks, Meryl Streep, you know, kind of drama, like character study dramas. This is much more colorful, and I don't use that in the sense of like the racial tensions and commentary, which is definitely a core facet of the story, but also like LED lights in a gigantic hoopty Uber and like dream sequences with lurid colors. I mean, there are sequences within this film that actually remind me a lot of different stage plays that I've seen.
Yeah.
It felt very theater.
Oh, completely.
Even though it was very, like, it's very modern, it's very contemporary, but it feels like a well-done theater piece that was filmed on the streets of Oakland.
Yeah.
And for that alone, I think it's wildly unique and totally worth a watch. And above and beyond that, it's got a lot of really great themes, excellent story execution. There's a lot of stuff that we'll talk about that I'm excited to talk about. But I agree it surprised me because I didn't know what to expect. The only thing that I saw before the film was they had released one of the early scenes where they're in the hoopty Uber. they had released basically the entire scene, seeing it in the movie. I see some things that they kind of trimmed it for time. But watching that scene, I still wasn't exactly sure what I was going to be watching. And so to see the final product, the whole movie start to finish, was really good. Because that scene alone did a pretty good job of sort of setting a tone for me, but it did not represent the entire film. There was a lot of additional richness and surprises, yeah. I thought, seeing the whole thing.
And I think I have to blame Chad, because I think Chad set the tone for me in saying, yeah, I think it's a comedy. I think it's a comedy. And I'm like,
well, that scene yeah, definitely is.
Yeah, that scene in particular is a comedic scene. But I'm like, okay, all right, it's a comedic film. Okay, yeah. Come out feeling like the world's on fire and everything else is going on, and I got emotions running left and right. I'm like coming out wiping snow. It wasn't a comedy, Chad. It wasn't a comedy. But it's true. There are so many facets to this story, and there's so many facets to this film and the way it was filmed. And I think literally in terms of expectations, the only thing I truly expected was just to see Oakland. Like whenever you know a film is being shot somewhere particularly, mm-hmm. When you know where it's going to be shot, you expect to see the place, obviously.
Right.
I knew nothing of the film. I didn't look up any trailers. I didn't look at any of the synopsises. All I knew was that it was going to be filmed in Oakland. It was filmed in Oakland. And oddly enough, the location of Oakland plays a key role in the entire film. And so I could honestly answer that in saying, you know, I kind of did see Oakland and I kind of didn't. I mean, the way just the film pans out, and like I said, we'll talk about it. But I wanted to ask Spencer something. So we were talking offline, and we're like, Spencer, I really, because of the fact that you were the one who had suggested this film, we really wanted you to kind of speak towards your mindset when it comes to this particular film and your thoughts on this particular movie. What was it about this film that really pulled you in terms of like really wanting to watch it? Aside from just being invited by a friend, I know you well enough to know I could invite you to see the worst movie or whatever, and you in your right mind will say, no, you're smart like that. But you usually have...
And you certainly wouldn't rope other people into seeing it if it was bad.
Oh, he'll
like
do
if
that.
It was a bad movie.
No, he does that automatically.
Well, not unless it's an entertaining bad. If no. I find it entertainingly bad,
Spencer,
I will rope people
I
in.
Will hang that The Amazing Bulk over your head for as long as we both shall live every time you say that. But no, I just want to know, like, what was it about the film that really pushed you? Like, what was the some of the factors about it that really made you say, okay, I gotta see that
The first time?
Yeah, the first time. I don't mean the second time, because obviously the second time it was because we didn't want to see it by ourselves.
No. Like, well, this is gonna be a bit disappointing, but like, honestly, the only reason I went to see this movie was because I was bored and had a lot of free time.
Well,
like, that was the entire reason.
But then coming out of seeing it the first time, you were not like belligerently insistent, but you were pretty insistent that we should see it and talk about it.
Yeah, because I knew, like, just like finishing this movie, I was like, yeah, this is definitely a film philosopher's type of movie of, like, you know, just getting into like what's so good about this film.
Yeah,
like, I knew this, that it was like our type of film. Mm-hmm.
okay,
I think you called that correctly.
Yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, no doubt. It was, like I said, this is one of those types of movies that the only reason why it's now populating on my YouTube account and all that is because I've been searching like a lot of the songs from the film and a lot of the segments and a lot of the pieces and a lot of the stuff that's been inspired by the film. Mm-hmm. So now it populates quite a bit on YouTube for me. But prior to that, I don't really think I can say I've seen much in terms of advertisements or even trailers, you know, show up.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me because, like I said, I try as much as I can, as much as anybody else that I know of, or probably not, but I try to kind of look for these types of films, and I kind of search them out, and I look for independent films, and this was one that just didn't really pop up for me, and I'm kind of bummed about that.
One of the things that I found very rich is after seeing the movie, like immediately after seeing the movie, Eddie, you and I had a brief conversation, mm-hmm. Leaving the theater in the car, and I confess to you, I'm like, I don't know how we're going to talk about this movie, because the reason I said that is because it's kind of like you need to see it for yourself. Like,
yeah.
We can go on and on. We can do an 8-hour episode trying to unpack things from this movie, do a play-by-play, literally read every single line of like freestyle rap and spoken word verse that's in it, because they are pretty cool elements of how the movie is done. But you still need to see it for yourself. It's an experience. It's rare to get a movie, any form of entertainment, movie, TV show, book, song, whatever, that is truly not only engrossing and creative in its execution, but it is blatantly, like, obviously an important commentary piece for our current day and time.
Very much so.
And it handles that in a direct way that in some ways it's confrontational, but in other ways it's very open and dare I say inviting. I mean, it invites you into the conversation while also calling a spade and really depicting sort of what does fear look like in certain contexts where it's not contrived. It's not like a horror movie kind of fear or even a sci-fi thriller kind of fear. Like, oh no, the aliens are invading and let's act scared. Like, it's not so much acting things out. It's embodying real experiences showing, like, ciphering it for an audience that may have seen news stories, read articles, whatever, but not just, like, sat and watched a human being who experiences that on an ongoing daily basis. And what does it mean for it to haunt your dreams? What does it mean for it to cripple you as you're trying to get ahead in life, just like everybody else around you? You know, like, there are a lot of things that this film does very eloquently and beautifully, you know, for all the horrific context of some of it, but it really does what it does beautifully, and it's worth you sitting in a chair in a movie theater kind of absorbing it for yourself.
Yeah.
And so coming away from the whole, like, how do we talk about this movie? Because it's really not something that you talk about and then somebody's like, okay, you gave it however many monocles and you passed it or failed it, and so I'm going to decide yes or no. Like, just if you're listening, if you're listening, go see the movie.
Yeah.
And I think you don't even have to like it.
No,
but go see it.
And I think that's one of the important things about you who is listening right now, currently. If you're listening to this episode, this is going to be more of a conversation that is stemmed from the film. I mean, we'll obviously try to give it a rating, but in all honesty, I don't think the rating is going to be that much important, as opposed to just this conversation that we're going to have. And one of the things that I just really want to highlight that Chad mentioned was, you've seen these types of films before. I mean, not to say that they're all the same, but to say that these films are usually created to emote and to really evoke a sense of, you know, call to arms mentality. Usually it's like a helping you see from the other side type of film. And the unique thing was that this film actually didn't do that for me. It actually created a connecting point where I actually could see myself in one of the positions that they portrayed on that side in the film. You know, it wasn't like, oh, this is a glimpse of what it's like over here. Like, you think of films like Boys in the Hood. Boys in the Hood is a great example of a film that talks about either it's talking about gentrification or it's talking about the chaos and the just whatever of the streets and everything. It just displays that so well, but it's more of from the perspective of the other side. It's like you're looking at their life and you're looking at what's going on for them. You see how that transpires. And in this film, what's so beautiful about it is that I felt like there was at least one or two people that were in this particular film that I'm like, yeah, I can relate to that. Yeah, that's a portion of me right there. That's a portion of me right there. And it immediately had me more engaged than previous films that we had seen that tried to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what one of the most beautiful things I really admired about this film. And that's a difficult thing to do, because when you're trying to create that sense of like, okay, we're going to make a statement. We're going to tell people that there's problems in the streets and there's this that's going on. And, you know, this is happening in this neighborhood and this is happening in that neighborhood. And it's usually, it makes you feel removed.
to an extent. Like, it makes you feel like, okay, well, doesn't really happen in my neighborhood, so I'm going to go watch it, I'm going to support it, and I'm going to be, you know, the guy that's like, oh yeah, right on. You know, that's how I feel, you know, power to the people kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, in all honesty, I mean, that's how I sometimes feel when I go in and I watch these types of movies. And it's interesting because in this particular film, I'm like, I'm watching it, and I'm like, yeah, that could be me tomorrow. That situation is so, you know, connected to my life that that's something that may have happened or has happened or will happen, you know, for me. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think that's one of the beautiful things about it. Another thing that Chad had mentioned was the, I'm sorry, did you want to say something on that?
No, I'm loving listening to you.
Oh, well, it's great to see, the two actors that kind of are the mainstays for this particular film. They're the two best friends, David Diggs and Rafael Casal it's crazy because they're in this film and they're literally like not only performing really well because they're great actors in this movie, but they're also incredible rappers and lyricists and individuals who are creating these, you know, rhymes that it's like, oh yeah, that's what's up, that's cool. And I was like, there's got to be more to these guys. And I feel it's moments like this when I jump onto IMDb and I start digging through and I feel so like dense. I'm like, oh my gosh, this person has such a rich history in doing this and this and that. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, this person has such a rich history. Like David Diggs. David Diggs, it's insane, but David Diggs, he is currently a rapper and he also appeared in Hamilton, one of the most famous Broadway musicals of this generation. And this man was in it. He played Thomas Jefferson, or the I believe it was the Marquis de Lafayette. I could be wrong. One of those two. He played a character in Hamilton.
Sorry, I'm not that cultured. I haven't seen Hamilton, so I know. Lambast me if you need to.
But it's crazy because...
But you're right. It is the Broadway show, yeah, of this current generation.
Exactly. And this gentleman has had a role. He's won a Grammy and a Tony for his roles in, you know, Hamilton. And it's insane because that's history there. That's somebody who has created and has performed and has excelled. And I'm over here looking at him like, so who's this guy? You know? And maybe that's just my mindset of just being in that little box of just kind of just focusing on movies. But It was humbling and it was honoring at the same time to be able to say, like, oh my goodness, like, as soon as we get offline here, I'm going to jump on, you know, online, and I'm going to jump on the internet and try to find as much of his content, because the man is brilliant. And also,
you know, here's one of those things, I do want to emphasize, like, if I were typing this out for you, I'd underline it or bold it or all of the above, you know, because so many of the movies that we typically review, let's take last week's review of The Meg, for example.
The Meg.
You know, all there are some big name, mediocre name, and unknown performers, yeah, in that film. Mm-hmm. The director has made several other films before that, but isn't necessarily, he's not a Spielberg or a, you know, Scorsese or anything, no, like that. But these folks go literally to every major market in the world during their press tour. And they talk about, like, what was it like filming in a water tank? What was it like filming on a blue screen, green screen, you know, mm-hmm, whatever? Did you believe in the size of the shark, or, you know? And there's so much, and they have to, like, I would be so dead tired, jet lagged beyond belief, if I had to be one of them answering literally the same 10 questions 80 times a day for a month straight. Oy. In different time zones. And so you get this, like, yeah, I hate sharks. And that was hard. Or, like, you just, you know, the eyes glaze over and they give the same answer. I mean, whatever. But then you get to these guys.
Yeah.
They started, yeah, working on the first version of this script almost a decade ago. They've been friends for a while. They have, you know, this, like you said, this rich history of performance at different levels.
Yeah.
Like, super famous and then, like, completely obscure, unknown, and have excelled in those areas. And you read some of the interviews that have taken place over this movie, where outlets have interviewed them. You hear, you were playing before we started this episode, an excerpt from a spoken word freestyle rap deal that they did at CinemaCon.
Yeah.
About the concept of blind spotting and, you know, the motivation behind this movie. It's so rich and there's so much there to talk about for them. Like, they're not like sitting in a room, you know, press junket after press junket after press junket. Like, yes, we made a movie. I am tired. Thank you. Like, there's so much depth to cover. And when you read some of these interviews and you hear some of the interviews, like, mm-hmm. the level at which their creativity is operating and the thought and consideration that has gone into this project is immense. It's,
oh yeah,
many, many times larger than a megalodon. So, yes. I would say, I guess to add on to my previous comment about, like, just go watch the movie. I also would say, like, go online and read some of the interviews, watch some of the videos. There's a lot more to kind of work through and experience than the hour and a half in the theater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if it's just like an hour and a half, you're kind of missing like half the experience of this movie. Like, because there's so much around it as well. A lot, like, because after I saw this movie, I was kind of like in a daze for a bit because I was like, it's so much to process, like, along with like, you know, main themes and messages of the movie. Like, some of just like the artistic style that they chose, like, some of the dream sequences were really just like, you know, made you stop and like go, wow, like, that was really amazing and heavy and kind of terrifying all at once. And it's just a lot to go through.
Yeah. Yeah, because you look at the film, and obviously the subject matter of the film is about somebody who's on their last 3 days of probation, being in a halfway house and just making sure those last 3 days are without incident so that he can be free. So there's already a level of expectation coming in, like, okay, it's going to be one of those. Mm-hmm. This guy's going to be tempted with this. He's going to be tempted with that. This is going to happen. Things going to happen. You think you know, like, the structure of the whole entire film. You feel like you're like, okay, this is the way the film opens. All right, then I know how the rest of the film's going to go. It's just going to be another one of those. Mm-hmm. And then the film actually begins opening, and like Chad had mentioned, that the music you had heard earlier in the episode, in the podcast, actually plays while they're showing scenes that are from Oakland, taken straight from locations in Oakland. And not just locations, but there are areas of Oakland that are either the way they currently are or the way they've been changed because of the migration of individuals who have found Oakland to be the place to live for right now.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned earlier that I lived in the Bay Area for a while. Mm-hmm. Part of my time in the Bay Area, I was living in Oakland. I taught with a national nonprofit organization called Teach for America. I was a middle school teacher in West Oakland as part of the Oakland Unified School District. And so basically the neighborhood, if you will, where these characters live is positioned as West Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of like, oh, I should recognize something in here.
Yeah.
And it's been a few years, I'll be honest. It's not like it was yesterday. It was a few years ago. But it was dizzying to me. That opening sequence to the operatic, you know, song score, it's not one image transitioning to one image, transitioning to one image. It's a split screen.
Yeah.
And both screens are switching back and forth. And at first you're thinking, okay, this is how you traditionally would view Oakland, and then this is the gentrification part. But then that it's not like a left brain, right brain thing. Like, they switch back and forth, and mm-hmm. some of them are static and some of them are moving and some of them are logos. I mean, you get like the outside of a Whole Foods market.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was a lot of visual information to take in all at once.
Yeah.
And I totally respect the reason why they did that way, because it is very like, kind of sets you off balance right from the get-go, because you're like, wait, I don't know what I'm supposed to focus on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they bring things into focus, you know, at their own discretion, at their own speed.
Yeah.
And I do love, Spencer, like you were talking about with the dream sequences, you know, because you do, you have like the basic setup, guy's on probation. He did something in the past. You don't know what it is. You don't know if it was fair for him to have been prosecuted mm-hmm. and, you know, put in jail and then, you know, out on probate. Like, you know, there's a lot of injustice that happens.
Yeah.
In the world at large. And specifically in these communities. I mean, I did teach there for a couple of years, and that doesn't make me an expert at all. However, it does make me a witness
yeah.
to a number of different activities, good and bad, you know, that not everybody gets to see. So there is a lot of injustice that happens in communities like West Oakland, where people are wrongfully arrested, wrongfully imprisoned, wrongfully, you know, everything. But you don't know at first, like,
yeah.
for a while, you don't know what he, quote unquote, did that had him in prison and now out on probation. And you're like, okay, this is his, you know, redemption narrative. And then there's temptation around him. And is he going to succumb? Is he going to get caught in the wrong situation, not of his making, and then put back in jail or whatever? There's
yeah.
there's that kind of almost like a ticking time bomb mm-hmm. kind of plot device.
Yeah.
And I don't say that tritely, but... But then you have these moments that totally interrupt
mm-hmm.
the ticking time bomb with emotional stakes and very relatable, actual, deep-seated, and justified fear. Like human yeah. fear, uncertainty, the future is unknown, not because I might end up in the wrong situation on purpose or on accident, but because the wrong situation might find me.
Yeah.
And the system already doesn't treat people like me the same as it treats other people.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like the lurid colors and the freestyle and the rap and the pacing and the tone and everything about these dream sequences, it interrupts the regular flow. It's like mm-hmm. we interrupt this regular broadcast for a special message, you know, yeah. and it's terrifying.
No, completely.
And then you get back to the ticking, you know, so then it raises the stakes really for that, you know, ticking clock kind of element of like, okay, he still isn't done with probation. Is he going to be okay? I don't know.
yeah.
You know, and then, you know, and it builds and it builds and it builds. The crescendo of this movie is unreal.
Yeah.
Unbelievably good.
Yeah.
And in a bad, like it's. Not like, oh wow, everybody's happy and there's like rainbows in the sky and whatever. Like it's extremely satisfying in ways that most creative products have a really hard time. Once you kind of hit your stride, then like doing a satisfying final conflict and
yeah.
resolution, you know, most things kind of drop the ball there because it's easy to do the build up and it's harder, you know, to kind of land that plane and stick the landing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love how those dream sequences interrupt the flow. And everything about this movie kind of just is like, well, wait, like I lived in Oakland for almost 3 full years. I was in this community, during the day as a professional. In the evening, I lived in another part of Oakland, not too, too far away, not super gentrified or anything, but, still like, I didn't recognize quite a few of the locales.
Yeah.
Because of the gentrification process has changed the look of the streets in some ways. And it looked like an unfamiliar place. And I said it's been years, but it hasn't been that long that it should look unfamiliar to me.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big part of the point of the story.
Yeah. One of the things real quick before we continue moving forward, if you're unfamiliar with the word gentrification, according to Webster's Dictionary, gentrification is the process of renewal and rebuilding accompanying the influx of middle class or affluent people into deteriorating areas that often displaces poor residences. So essentially it's when the individuals who feel like they can make a place better by creating more expensive housing for individuals who currently live in the area can't pay for and can't live and can't sustain. So they're pushed out to make way for an upper class set of people, which, I mean, if we're being honest, it occurs in a lot of places. It's occurring here in our own city in Sacramento. It's occurred in a lot of the major cities that you may know of. It occurs in a lot of the smaller cities or towns that you may not have. It's that mindset that somebody can make the neighborhood better by pushing out the people who have made the neighborhood rich to begin with. Yeah. And it's something that's been going on for a while. I mean, like I said, Boys in the Hood was a film that was done early 90s, and that film talks about gentrification. There are other films out there ever since then. I mean, it's not a brand new thing, but we're now reaping what has been sown long ago, and it's an opportunity now for people like David Diggs and Rafael Casal and even the director Carlos Lopez Estrada to kind of bring it to light, especially in an area as rich with history and culture and you know, and just information and stuff like Oakland. You know, it's interesting, you know, and scary at the same time. One of the things I wanted to touch on, which I know Chad will probably be excited to kind of build on, is the way this structure of this film is made. So it's not your typical type of film. Usually your typical type of film is like a 3-point story. You have your inciting incident, your climax, and your resolution, so to speak. This is not one of those films. It is very much so built like a stage play, like a theater play.
It feels very theater. I mean, and that's really hard to describe. And I don't say that as like a, well, if you don't know theater, then you won't get this story. But I mean, for someone who has seen stage produced stories, so they're live on a stage in front of you versus film, there is a difference in the way that those mediums mm-hmm. present stories, the way that it feels to sit through the story and kind of experience with the characters. And for whatever reason, blind spotting this film, by the end of it, I was like, okay, I went in, feels very much like a movie. It's, yeah. you know, you got your montage that we talked about yeah. at the beginning, showing different aspects of gentrification and just the blending of cultural influences and all of that. And it feels very movie. Like, it feels like a movie.
Yeah.
And you've got, like, the, you know, 3 days left on probation, like, the title keys, mm-hmm. like, the actual words on the screen. That feels very much like a movie.
Yeah.
And then you get into some of these dream sequences.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh.
And some of the framing of the shots, even the hoop-de-uber. I don't know why I keep saying that, but it's a very nice looking car, but it's like way up on hydraulics, gigantic tires, LED lights on the inside. It is tricked out to the max. But that scene is also very, very close for most of it. And feels like the way you would see a scene set in a car done on a stage.
Yeah.
Versus in a movie. And so, you know, the more that you kind of live through the experience of the movie, like, I came out thinking, like, I feel like I just watched an interpretation, a modernization of a Shakespeare play.
Yeah.
That's what I feel like, because you've also got all the wordplay and just those stylistic touches that, I mean, typically it's like you don't see that hardly ever in mm-hmm. movies. You do see it more often on stage.
Yeah.
People take risks like that, and you kind of need that that pop and that sizzle and the wordplay and everything to keep something as dated and traditional as a stage play interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but it's just like, I literally, I walked out, I said, I don't know that reminds me of a specific Shakespeare play, but it felt like I watched a modernization of a Shakespeare play. That's what I felt like walking out of the theater walking out of the movie theater. Yeah. Sorry. Now I'm getting my terms all confused.
yeah. Like, if you had mentioned like the term theater, like it felt very theater to me, like last month, I had to have no idea what you're talking about. But now that I've seen this, I instantly get it. And I think it's one of those things where you kind of have to see what you're talking about to really get like how it's so very different, because yeah, I can't think of any movie that I've seen this year that's been like this one has.
Yeah.
Because this one just is shot differently and does things in a way that is not quite like anything else I've seen recently. Because like, I had like actual panic dread for this man. Was like, I really didn't know if he was going back to jail. I was like, are you, aren't you, what's happening with your life right now? So like, the whole time I was watching him during my first sit through, I was like, this is just aggravating.
Sure. Yeah, and I think that's one of the things in terms of like I said, I don't want to lump all these films that they do like this in the same category, but there's typically a process or a structure that most of them go through, and you've come to kind of expect with some of them the ebbs and flows of most of these films. And this was one of those films where, like I was saying earlier, you expect it to be one thing in the beginning, like you said, the montage at the beginning and whatnot, and like, all right, it's going to transition into this, we're going to meet our people, blah, 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 this is going to happen, blah, blah, blah. But then things like going back to the broken record that we've been talking about with that dream sequence, Lord above, there's two particular dream sequences that I believe are the most interesting out of the entire film. I'm pretty sure there was more, but there was two that really haunted me. And the thing that caught my attention most out of those sequences wasn't just the fact that it was a dream sequence, but the fact of that there was vivid colors and it was almost like a mini performance within the film itself, but it wasn't isolated. It was still a part of the entire project, the entire film. And it was like, there was still connecting points. It wasn't a one-off, like, somebody's dreaming, like they're in war, and then all of a sudden they start dreaming about going back home and or whatever, or something that, bad example, but something that's not completely connected to the current state of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it interrupts the flow. It honestly, once I sat down and thought about it the next day after staying up really late watching this movie and being like, whoa, I don't know how to talk about this. The next day I was thinking about it again fresh, and I thought, you know, honestly, stylistically speaking, it reminded me a lot of Julie Taymor's work. Julie Taymor was, most people would probably be familiar with the Broadway musical adaptation of The Lion King, Disney's The Lion King, and how, you know, it's done a number of national tours. Maybe you've, I mean, it's been running on Broadway for like 20 years. And so the way that the character design is done, like, it's clearly a human performer with this puppet sort of very beautiful developed puppet, and they've got, you know, like the colors and everything going on. Also from a film standpoint, she did Across the Universe.
Yeah.
And a lesser seen film, a Shakespeare adaptation called Tiberius. I believe it's called Tiberius.
Tempest?
She did The Tempest as well, but yeah. I have not seen that one. But it's basically because she comes from primarily a stage background, a theater background.
Yeah.
Even in the, like, you know, movie work, let's say Across the Universe, which is probably the one that most people would have seen if they've seen anything of hers. You've got, like, the, you know, the love story between the two people. You've got the Beatles soundtrack and all of that. But you have these almost like acid trip kind of dream sequence elements that happen throughout the film. And it interrupts the, you know, business as usual kind of plot point A to plot point B to plot point C kind of motion. And very similarly here in Blindspotting, you have a 3-point plot. You do actually have a very regular, normal story that, in terms of, you know, like the timing of when certain things happen, is predictable. However, it does, like Spencer was saying, it definitely keeps you on your toes. There's no guarantee one way or the other exactly what's going to happen by the end of this film.
Mm-hmm.
You feel the stakes, you feel the danger, you feel the uncertainty, and you're not sure how it's going to end. And I think a lot of that is because of these dream sequences, because they put you on edge. They're very, in most every moment of the sequences, they're very threatening.
Yes.
And it seems to be the filmmaker and writing team of the movie foreshadowing an ending that you don't want to see.
Mm, yeah.
And that's one of the things that really stands out for this particular film. It's it's a constant build of tension that isn't like a horror film, kind of like what you're saying earlier. It's not like Alien. It's not like, you know, a film where you're expecting to the main character to be eaten or destroyed or blown up, or you find out he's actually the bad guy. Or it's none of those instances in this film. There's a sense of true realistic dread that is translated in this film throughout the entire movie. And it's based on sincerity. He doesn't want to go back to jail. He doesn't want to have to deal with this all over again. He doesn't want that life. He's not like, oh, well, I got, you know, I'm out here in these streets. I got to do this, this, and that. This man wants to have a better life, and he's trying. And everything around him, it's like playing Jenga. Everything around him, there's pieces that are falling here and there. He's still standing, but pieces are falling here and there. And then this happens, which that's one of the shakeups I kind of wanted to mention. That big shakeup happens at the very beginning of the film when he sees somebody get shot. And you think, oh, going back to my thought of, you know, oh, this is going to be one of those other films. Okay, whatever. And then that happens and you're like, oh, he's in big trouble. And he's let go. And essentially he's kind of given his own freedom to process through that. It's crazy because I personally don't know what I would do if I saw something like that. And I can only imagine, like, it'd be something like that. He went through some crazy fever dreams and just trying to figure out and process through his own emotionality. And it translates really well in this film.
Yeah. And ultimately it breaks into his lived reality too. It's not only in the dream sequences that he processes all of this uncertainty. I mean, there's a visual refrain that happens in the movie as well, which is that he wakes up from a dream sequence with his alarm and he goes for a jog. And the elements of the dream sequence interrupt to greater effect every time he goes on a jog.
Yeah.
It interrupts his daily life more, to the point where the last jog that you see has a very memorable, in a horrifying kind of way, very memorable sort of fusion almost of what his dreams have been telling him or warning him about, and then what he's literally trying to run away from, but it's confronting him. Like he can't not see this, you know, this reality all around him. And again, I think it's extremely well done.
Yeah.
I think it's not only like competent storytelling, I think it's masterful storytelling.
Oh, by far. Mm-hmm. And that's just a credit to not only the ability to translate the story, but even to be able to just visually put it on display and to be able to just go forward and create the imagery, because a lot of the film is translated through its imagery. But I did want to kind of touch on personal aspects and so forth. And Spencer, I kind of wanted to bring you into the fold, Mr. Williams. This film, obviously we're living in a time where right now it's interesting because of the fact, and I use the term interesting loosely, because it's dangerous. It's scary. We live in a world where individuals who are different sometimes have targets on them by people who just don't like them. It's a world that is privy to violence first, discussion later. And this is one of those films that highlights that at the very beginning. And I wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, what were some of your thoughts watching the film, not after the fact, I mean during the course of the movie, as you were watching, like, some of the things, because I mean, elephant in the room, I'm not gonna just state it, but you are African-American, as I'm a minority as well. Uh-huh. You know, so we don't have the same struggles, but we do have similar
ones, yeah,
in certain aspects. And I mean, I know for me, growing up in Texas, Texas is very split right down the middle. You have to stay in the center part of Texas or the west part of Texas, because if you start going east, you start hitting closer to that Louisiana line, and you get them good old boys who drive trucks, you know, and carry their shotguns with them and aren't very friendly. Mm. And so I've always known that growing up, and seeing things like this in this movie and recognize it's like, for me, it seemed like an updated version of that, of what was going on in this particular instance, and seeing that type of thing, like, you know, there's no reason to hate me just because I'm different, but still there's a level of that somewhere, even if it's been updated, even if it's now in the 2000s, now in 2018. I mean, what were some of your thoughts when you were watching this? What were some of the things that came to your mind?
There's no, like, large overarching thoughts. I was just kind of really taking the movie in, like, piece by piece. You know, certain scenes, like, stood out to me, like the initial, like, oh, he sees someone get shot and the cops, like, just standing here and then looks at him. And I'm like, why are you sitting there? Don't look back at him. He'll memorize your face if he needs to shoot you later to cover up his tracks or something.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
No, it's true.
Yeah. So it was really just stuff like that. The only, like, yeah, the dream sequences, I talked about that before. Those, like, really stood out. And, like, just, like it kind of takes a lot to, like, make me stop thinking and just, like, watch what you're doing.
Yeah.
And, like, some of those, like, the dream sequences were just out of this world.
Yeah.
But I think the only other thing that really got my head turning is the best friend character in this movie has a kid. And at one point, he's, like, his mom is trying to teach him how to talk to the police. And it comes up later when he's bothering one of the main characters. Like, one of the main characters gets in his face and points at him, and he says, "I said stop." And then the kid puts up his hand and says, "Don't shoot." And I was like, ugh, that's just so depressing.
Yeah.
Like, right there, that whole thing where it's like, you know, you have to, because you look a certain way.
Yeah.
You need to act a certain way, and hopefully you're able to survive, like, you know, an encounter with the police.
No, and that's, see, it's true. Like, learning, the fact that that has to be taught
at a young age. There was a pamphlet in this movie.
There was a pamphlet on how to talk to your kids on how to deal with the police.
Yeah.
And this child was like, what, 5, 6? He wasn't old. I mean, he was still in preschool, I believe.
Yeah, I would guess probably around 4. Yeah.
4 or 5. And he's already learned the rhetoric to help him stay alive in a world that shouldn't have to be. And the fact remains is that that's something that there are parents who do that. There are those pamphlets out there.
My father did that with me. Like,
really?
That was one of the discussions I remember from when I was a child. It was just like, yeah, if the police, like, ever want to talk to you or anything, make sure you don't put your hands in your pockets. Make sure they can see what you're doing at all times. Like, yeah. Don't hide anything from them. Like, I remember that, like, vividly from, like, my childhood.
Wow. Yeah, like, on for me, it was one of those things. I used to play football all the time, so we would travel quite a bit, and they would have to sit down with us, because the majority of our team was either Hispanic or African American. Mm-hmm. So it was always interesting traveling to East Texas, not to give them a bad name, but it was just nature at the time. And it was always weird to sit down, and the coach would be like, "Okay, listen, guys, if we get pulled over for any reason, just make sure you keep your hands on the seat that's in front of you. If they open the doors, you follow everything they say. Don't go with anybody anywhere." And they're like, "We know stranger danger is a big deal, but do not let anybody take you anywhere else. Don't, you know, don't aggravate. Don't get into any confrontations. Just keep your head down and keep moving." And I used to think that was like, okay, because they don't want to have us deal with anybody, you know, that whatever. And it wasn't until there was an actual altercation in one of the East Texas towns that we went to that I got one of my first real doses of racism in my lifetime, and it was crazy. We were sent to East Texas, and the police officer was like, you know, hey, or no, I'm sorry, the gas station guy was like, hey, y'all ain't planning to go through the highway at night, are you? And we're like, well, we're just trying to go 10 miles up. And he's like, nope, you don't want to do that. Boy, I tell you what, you got all them. And he used his words about who was in the van. And he's like, nope, you don't want to travel with them in that car at this late at night. And so sure enough, we pulled off, found the nearest little motel. And there was so many things that happened in that trip that I'd love to talk to you guys about and say it, but therapy first. Just, because a lot of that really solidified my mindset in terms of like the fact that I had to know that in high school. I can only imagine what has already been taught to those younger than I am, mm-hmm. who have had to actually face this kind of thing. And to know that, you know what, there are kids who have to know, going back to the movie, who have to know things like that because of the fact that there's no trusting anybody in certain situations. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know I'm not saying that every officer is bad, and that's like saying as well on the other side, not every Hispanic person is bad, not every African-American person is bad, not every minority is up to something bad, not every white person is rich, not every there's a lot of stereotypes, but in certain instances when you have to be careful or be aware, it's unfortunate that it has to go to that level. And I think that's one of the things that this film really digs deep into and helps you recognize, because of the fact that it's a wake up, if not a wake up call, but it's a sobering moment, if you will, for the main character when he sees that and he's like, whoa, like it stops him cold in his tracks when the little boy puts his hands up and is like, stop, don't shoot, thinking it's a game. The little boy looks like he thinks it's a game when he says it,
yeah,
in just like a playful response, but it's like it's life or death in that moment. And he's looking at it like, yeah, I've seen what happens when on the opposite side, when that doesn't, you know, when you don't put your hands up and things like that. So,
well, and it's really elegantly put. There are two main characters in this story. The main character is Colin, who is Divvy Diggs' character. He's the one on probation. And then his friend from childhood, Miles. The other main character. And he's white, but he's grown up in the same neighborhoods. And he has his own flow, his own way of speaking. Yeah. I mean, he does his whole, like, almost like a spoken word auctioneer deal in a hair salon and with some dude regarding a sailboat type thing on the street. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely humor in this movie. That's one of the things that makes it so good, is that it balances all the tension with genuinely engaging funny humor.
Yeah.
That's unlike most of what you see in comedy films. So it's a really nice blend. Miles is the character that provides most of the humor,
mm-hmm.
up until near the end of the movie, where a mistake is made early on that then impacts things later in ways that are very personal to all of the characters that you're following. And in sort of reacting to the reality of not only the mistake itself, but how bad it could be if things were fully followed through. And we won't tell you what that is. Again, you need to see this movie for yourself. Yes. But, there comes a point where Miles becomes violent and, you know, kind of just goes off the leash, mm-hmm. for a little while because of his frustration and whatnot. And Colin's trying to reel him back in. It's extremely touchy, extremely dangerous. And they have this altercation in like an abandoned warehouse parking lot type area. And you're not sure, like, police officers could come over any moment. They would certainly be justified in having been called over because of what happened immediately prior.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this very, very well done interaction between these two main characters, where basically it's over the use of terminology and identifier terminology, who can use what language and who cannot, and how that, because language is such an important part of this story, and how they leverage words, because they're both very, your two main performers are both very accomplished word artists.
Yes.
And so words are very important, paying attention, even when the everything's flowing pretty fast and it's like, I don't know what the dude in the car just said, but he bought a sailboat, you know? And it's great. But then you get to the use of a particular word.
Yeah.
And it's not even where they don't even get to a point where the characters say to each other, don't you get it? You're allowed and you're not allowed and whatever. Like, it gets right up to the point, but they've already made their statement without being like beat you over the head obvious. Mm-hmm. You can see in the characters' faces how conflicted they are that this is a reality between them as good lifelong friends.
Yeah.
But it's still a reality that they can't get away from. And I thought it was just really poignant. It's hard, but also very almost, it's almost a release of tension in a way to see it represented on screen in a dynamic like theirs, you know, where it's not members of a certain community and police, and that's your only source of conflict. That is one of the layers of conflict in this story. Surprisingly, it's kind of the B story conflict. It's a constant presence and it's a constant threat, and it definitely comes into play at numerous points in the story. But beyond that kind of societal level, and how it plays out between people groups, there's also the influences of, you know, societal problems on personal relationships, close personal relationships. And that's where you get the depth of emotion, like how sad it is, how disappointing it is, and yet how inescapably real it is. Because they basically behave like brothers in a way.
Oh yeah,
much
throughout
of
the entire
time.
Film,
and yet they can't change the fact that society, because of the color of their skin, society has influences on them, and one has more freedom than the other.
Yeah, yeah. I was just gonna say, and I think because I was gonna say that's another highlight of that particular scene, in recognizing that one may behave a certain way and the other one may not, but because of the skin color, that barrier that there already sets one of them automatically on one side, which more than most happens to be the better side because he's white or because whatever. Rather, but the scene allows you to see that, you know what, out of the two of them, one of them is definitely the person who the cops are looking for. They're the one. That particular person is the exact MO that these cops are expecting to see when they run into somebody from Oakland or somebody from that particular community. And I thought that was a big eye opener right there. Like, there was a lot to unpack in that particular scene, but to see it put that way, and the way it's phrased and the way that scene ends out, it's like he's right. Mm-hmm. Because how many times have we seen that where we all know somebody who thinks they're a certain way and they try to be a certain way around everybody else and so forth, and you see it and like, okay, they're just playing, but then you realize there are people who are like that who have grown up and have been, they're a part of that culture, they're a part of that community, they're a part of that, and it's like, yeah, they're just as much the same as anybody else. It's not a matter of, you know, you being white or black or Asian or Indian, you know, you need to recognize that there's a reason to
well, you know. In a way, it's sort of like, you know, I've heard many times, and this is from an outside point of view, obviously, I am Caucasian. I grew up in a very predominantly
Spencer,
white
know this?
Community.
No.
you know, but I did teach in Oakland. I and I have, in a way that fills me with joy, I have made friends with people of many different backgrounds, both within the United States and outside of the United States. You know, not just what's the lived reality here, where this has been like a poison that's been infecting our society for generations upon generations, but also like there are other perspectives outside of our country where there are some similarities, there are some differences. The more voices you're able to listen to and to really hear, the bigger and broader the story becomes in many ways. But one thing that I've heard many, many times from an outside perspective, again, is specifically, and I know this is true outside the African American community, but within that community, the notion of, you know, as a person who is black in America, your every action, your every word, your every thought carries the weight of that entire community.
Mm.
The choices you make in terms of what food to eat in a restaurant.
Yeah.
Where and how to drive your car. Where and how to speak to a person. Regardless of what background that other person has. You carry the weight of like the entire legacy of your people.
Yeah.
And that feeling is not the same for like many people who are white, even if you have strong respect for your family, loyalty, dedication, all that pride in like your upbringing or whatever.
Yeah.
You don't feel the pressure that you have to at all times be the best possible representation for people who look like you or have the same skin color as you. Regardless of how you feel about in terms of affinity, like, do we have anything in common beyond that? I don't know. But there's more freedom to not have to, you know, bear that weight. And in this scene, about like who can use what words and whatever, I mean, like you said, it's very clear there are prejudices at play every second of every day.
Yeah.
In the police force, in other people in the neighborhood, in, you know, whomever. Insert people group here, and like you said, they're going to assume one over the other. It doesn't matter that, you know, it's kind of like Miles is, in a way, while he's reacting to some serious circumstances in his life poorly, in a way he's allowed to act a fool. He's free to act a fool in ways that Colin is never, has never been free. And will, especially now that he's on probation, like he certainly will never be free to act that way. And yet, if Miles is acting that way and Colin is not, they're still coming after Colin.
Yes.
Yeah.
Miles could actually like kind of fade into the background and go home. And nobody would be the wiser. You know, and in fact, perhaps it's been that way their entire friendship relationship.
Yeah.
And so it's a very hard truth, but it's so elegantly presented. I mean, it's not elegant in like a ball gown kind of way, but it's presented in a very accomplished manner.
Yeah.
That you're sitting there just kind of reevaluating all kinds of things. I was reevaluating all kinds of things in my life. I won't put it on anybody else. And no. You're sitting there thinking, wow, yeah, that. I've confronted this before, and yet I am confronting it again, and I don't feel like it's poking me in the eyes so much as it's just like holding my eyes open.
Yeah, yeah. And that's I think one of the beauties of that's probably the most beautiful thing about this film is this is not a film that is meant to be set on fire so that it can be the display of everybody and everybody can feel, you know, like, oh, I have to react now, or I have to do this. I saw this film, now I have to. There's no forcing of people to be like, oh, now I have to do something because I now have the information, or I now have. That's not the case with this particular film. Although if you feel that way, by all means, feel that way. But the one thing this film really does do for you is to give you a front row seat and an opportunity to connect directly, not only with the main character, but with the main characters, plural, and understand that this is the current world we live in. Not just the world that was a few years back, not just back when, when Fruitvale Station came out, or when, you know, this happened with, you know, during this time, or any of those instances. It's not about a moment in time. It is about the future of our time, because everything that is happening in this film is happening now. It's happening in the relevance of today, which means tomorrow is still yet to be written in my mind. And I look at this film and I'm like, this is exactly what, you know, we need to see as a people, as just humanity, to recognize it's not about fighting those who have the place of the power, but it is about helping our communities be stronger and more aware and recognize what is going on around us, and seeing that it doesn't have to go that way. We can move forward. We can be better as a community, as a group of people. I think it's completely true that you were saying about, you know, as individuals, whether if you're African American, whether if you're Hispanic, whether if you're Native American, Indian, Asian, however, we do carry a lot of that. I do think that there is a lot of weight placed on a singular person's action of that particular ethnicity, because of the fact that you look at somebody who does one thing and immediately there's groups of people who think, well, that's what they all do, or that's how they always act, or that's how this is the way. And I mean, that probably has become the perpetuated mindset that has caused a lot of the issues that we have. We are now reaping from what has happened, sure, in the past. Mm-hmm. And so looking at it moving forward, it's like this film has allowed us to see it doesn't, we don't have to carry that weight. We got enough things going on ourselves. We can move forward and we can strive to be better, because there are better days ahead. We can look forward to better days ahead, kind of thing. So any last words before we kind of wrap this up, Spencer? Any last thoughts, anything on the film closing up?
Yeah, you've seen it twice now. Yeah. So you're at an advantage over us. Is there anything that like jumped out at you the second time, or kind of like re-emphasized a point, or it's something you just didn't notice the first time around?
Because it is
a lot to take in the first time around. It is a lot.
The first time there's just like so much. It's like, wait, why is that? And then like sometimes the movie's like, oh, we're going over here now. So if you haven't processed it, too bad.
You haven't processed it, too bad.
We're moving on.
But seeing it the first time, now that I actually knew, like, you know, I didn't have like that impending doom because I knew how the movie ends. It was easier to like, you know, look at things and be like, oh, this is why this is happening. Like the intro, like why they kept swapping sides. Like I was like, oh, yeah, I get it. Like it makes a lot more sense then. And like certain things on like later on, like there's a few parts where like they're trying to take in something, but I was like, I don't quite follow what we're doing here. But now on second view, I was like, oh, okay, I'm like picking up all the things I missed the first time. Mm. This was really great. So yeah, really helpful seeing this movie twice.
And I'm just gonna come out and ask it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'll be that guy. Uh-huh. As a black man in America, as an African American in the nation that we currently live in, how do you feel knowing these types of things not only have happened, but they currently happen? How do you feel about movies like this being put in theaters and showing people and allowing people to see? Like, honestly, we wouldn't have known about the thing with your dad and him teaching you that had we not have seen the film and had that talked about and things like that. How do you feel after seeing this particular film? And do you think this is going to help, or do you think this is going to hurt that type of mindset moving forward?
You like to ask the long, complicated questions, don't you?
I do.
I don't feel like this is going to hurt anything at all. But I feel like it's going to run into the problem of, you know, who's going to go see it, because this movie can only help you if you see it, like so many other things in life. Because, like, you know, we had a pretty awesome conversation, and I feel like this movie kind of spawns, like, conversations to have. So, like, it really, like, depends on, like, who goes and sees it, really. Because if it's needed in a place where people won't go see it, like, it's not going to really do anything there, really.
I think, too, like, most movies these days are really created to be products that you consume. Like, you sit, and as much as I love Marvel Cinematic Universe films, it's not like they're not, most of them are not structured in a way that's supposed to make me reflect about my life and my neighbors down my street, and really think about how we do or don't interact with each other and what that means for our entire society moving forward. It's about a good guy and a bad guy fighting each other. Sometimes it's a team, you know? And the movie itself is a product. I consume it, and then I like it enough to consume it again, etc. Sort of like food. Something like this is much more of a thought starter. It's not really... It almost kind of... if the movie were a creature, it's like it wriggles around just enough so that you can't consume it. It's just avant-garde enough, and it's not avant-garde, but it's avant-garde enough to somewhat defy classification. Is it a comedy? Is it a drama? Is it something in between? Is it a film or a musical? Like, is it a play or a musical structure? Also somewhat defies classification. Depends on how you feel about spoken word and rap. And in terms of the themes and the conversation starters, like you were mentioning, Spencer, you know, it's really what happens afterward. Like, you see it, you let it kind of sink in, and then what? It doesn't just disappear. I think some people obviously can go see it and say, ah, that wasn't my cup of tea, and it sort of does disappear. But I think for most people, if you were to see it, it's not something that just disappears. No. It really does provoke you to start thinking through things for yourself. One of the things that I read, and I'll stop blabbing after this, right before we started the episode, I read an interview on The Wrap. It was the Wrap with a W. It's a movie website, entertainment website. And they had interviewed both of the stars of the film, co-writers, etc. And David Diggs, who plays the main character, Colin, they were asking, you know, essentially, like, what should people take away from the film? Like, what should they be thinking at the end? And his response was really poetic, and I thought was like, yeah, that's how I felt. He said, I don't think we, the filmmakers, I don't think we were trying to prescribe an outcome that led you to believe one thing or another. It's going to depend on where your point of entry is and in the discussions you have with your friends and neighbors afterward.
Yeah.
And I think, like, once you see it for yourself, you'll know that's extremely authentic. That's very true.
100%. Yeah. Well, with that said, we're going to go around the table, and I don't know about monocles. I feel like if we're going to talk about this, I just feel like a pass or fail is probably good enough for me. I don't know how you guys feel, unless you guys want to do monocles.
No, I don't really feel like this movie needs it.
Neither do I. I just, in terms of the reasons why I'm going to pass it, because I'm going to pass it, I feel like this film really speaks to our current generation. I feel like there's an opportunity to learn not only from just a minority culture or a minority group, but from everybody, humanity-wide. I mean, you can look at this from a humanitarian standpoint, or from an American standpoint, or even just your city-proud standpoint. However, there's something in this film that everybody can latch onto and use as a fixture of hope and a fixture of learning we as a society need to move forward. We cannot stay stuck in the past, and we have to holistically together move forward. And so that's the reason why this film passes for me. What about you, Chad?
Yeah, I would say not only does the movie pass for me, I mean, that's, I think it's obvious, it's going to pass for all of us. I want this movie to win so many awards.
Yeah.
Like, it's some people who could really appreciate and benefit from something like this will not see it unless it gets some Oscar buzz or, you know, People's Choice, Golden Globes, whatever. I want it to be nominated numerous times. I want it to win numerous times. It's a very accomplished piece of art.
Yes.
And it accomplishes it, it pulls off something that very, very few films even try in the first place. And I think it totally nails it. So Not only do I say, yeah, the movie passes, but number one, you should go see it if you haven't already. And number two, I really want it to win a lot of awards so that other people that you know who don't listen to our podcast will also be influenced and inspired to go see it.
True. Spence?
You know, I hear the term that, like, movies are art, and usually I roll my eyes and I'm like, okay, as I watch Captain America throw a shield at someone. But
totally art, by the way.
That sounded like a jab at Chad, I'm just saying.
No, it wasn't. But this movie, I'm like, I get it. Like, this movie is art, and I love it. And it's just so amazing that everyone should just see this movie, because, yeah, it should win tons of awards, because it's just amazing and masterfully done. Like, I have nothing to really compare it to, which is kind of weird for me. Where it falls, which is kind of everywhere because it doesn't really fall in one place. But it's just such a well-done movie that really everyone should see it.
True. That wraps up another awesome conversation on the film Lost for Us. Again, if you have a comment about this particular film or if you'd like to share your opinion, drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlostifers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. We'd love to hear you, and we can't stress enough, this film is definitely worth the watch. It is definitely one that you should take at least your teenagers, if you have family, take, you know, fellow members of your family if they're old enough to understand, and go and see this film. This is definitely worth watching. It's worth discussing over, and I'm pretty sure this isn't going to be the end of this conversation for us here on the Filmlossifers, but in terms of this episode, we are coming to a close. Just to let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases, we got Crazy Rich Asians, which debuts this weekend. So if you're not going to see Blindspotting, that's available as well. But got to support all them. So
what does that even mean?
Support all the films.
Support all them.
Support everybody.
Movies.
Fantastic.
It's a great way to end the podcast.
Don't there. Judge me. Don't. How dare you?
Don't you steal my line.
Like I said, that about wraps up another episode. So from all of us here at the Filmlossifers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.